Have a motion and a second to approve the minutes. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, minutes are adopted. Then we'll move right into testimony. And we'll start off with the duties of the Secretary of State. And Mr. Spano is here, and I hope you will tell us a little bit about the office. And in particular, I'd appreciate if you would spend some time on your duties regarding election security and that aspect of your life, if you would. So welcome to the Compensation Council.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Jake Spano. I am the Deputy Secretary of State, just two floors up. Our duties fall into sort of three categories that I'll walk through all of those with you today: elections, business services, and we administer the Safe at Home program, which is address confidentiality program. We'll talk about all of those, and then I'm happy to take any questions at the end. So first page, and I apologize. Let me bring up the right. So here you see sort of a general sense of the staffing in our office. As you will note, that while we are predominantly known for our work in elections, business services is by far the largest department in our agency, or in our organization, based on sheer numbers of staff. So we'll talk a little bit about that one first. The business services division. And I'm not going to read every one of these slides. You all have this information, but
we appreciate that.
Yes, of course.
We're all pretty good readers.
Yes, so you are. So I won't bother with that. But
not everybody follows your rule, but that's good.
Essentially, we are the starting point for any entity that wishes to do business in the state of Minnesota. Whether you are a Minnesotan, whether you are a foreign company, whether you're from Delaware, it doesn't matter. If you want to form a business, a nonprofit, anything like that, you will start with our office. We also do a lot of sort of basic administrative things around copying. We get a lot of requests for articles of incorporation and what have you. Within the business services division, we have something called the UCC. These folks handle the Uniform Commercial Code, largely around loans. So we sort of administer the UCC piece. We also do the central notification system, which is for farm products. It's an interesting piece that not a lot of people know, but for those of you who may be from greater Minnesota, farmers can take out loans on the crop that they will harvest in the fall. They can take out a loan to get the seed corn, for example. Those loans are filed with our office, and so that when that farmer goes to sell their corn to the grain elevator at the end of the season, those files are checked to make sure that if there's any liens taken out on that on those harvests, that those are recorded and paid for. So it's an important piece that that we handle. So whether you are a farmer in, let's say, Polk County, or you are one of Minnesota's Fortune 500 companies, or you are a small business person in Dakota County, you work with our office. We have sort of a footprint throughout the state. Here you'll just see a couple of quick numbers to give you some context for these. This averages last year about 270 new entities and businesses every single day in the state of Minnesota, and about 1,750 renewals every single day in our office. So once you file as a business in the state of Minnesota, you are required annually to renew that filing. And so you can see that we have a very robust business community here in the state of Minnesota. One of the new things that we're working on is the Minnesota Business Snapshot. This is a voluntary survey that is provided to people who are filing both their original paperwork as well as their renewal paperwork with our office. And it's a voluntary 5-question survey that seeks to find out some basic information about the business climate in Minnesota, number one, for some economic analysis that St. Cloud State does for our office. But more importantly, to help connect business people to one another for the purposes of doing business. And this started with the secretary when he was asked by a military veteran, I would like to do business with other veterans, but I have no way to find them. There is no central registry of veteran-owned businesses in the state of Minnesota. And so we came up with, in working with our partners at St. Cloud State, the state demographer, the governor's office at the time, Deed, Commerce, a number of different entities, a series of five questions, and you see them here. We ask questions about the number of employees that they have here in Minnesota. We ask about them self-identifying as a member of as a woman-owned business, or a recent immigrant-owned business, community of color, veteran, or disabled person. We ask them what industry they might be in. So this would be using something called the NAICS code, which is a standard code. Because one of the things you can't tell right now, or you couldn't tell before this, was Spano Incorporated could be a coffee company. It could be an accounting firm. There was no way to tell those sorts of things. So we asked that question, whether or not they're a full or part-time business and what their gross revenues are for the previous year. I will say that when we launched this in 2016, the secretary and I talked about this and thought, you know, if we could get 10% of the folks to fill out this voluntary survey, we thought that would be a good start. We've been overwhelmed at the response rate. Right now, I just checked for this last month's numbers because these were taken from the 60% was taken from a prior report. We're at about 58.8% response rate. So very, very good response rate. We're very excited about that. We are, the secretary would probably let me go if I came back to the office without reminding folks, we are a net contributor to the state. We contribute $22 million per biennium through our business service fees. Some of those fees our office keeps, some of them we do not. What we're best known for is elections administration. So we work with cities and counties around the state to make sure that they, as the sort of boots on the ground folks running elections, have what they need. We operate and maintain the statewide voter registration system, which is the database of all the registered voters in the state of Minnesota. We accept filings. We train local election officials. We do recounts, most of them anyhow. And right now, we're preparing for the 2020 presidential primary, which will be a new piece of elections administration for our locals. We also do quite a bit of voter outreach to engage communities around the state to make sure that they are aware of their rights and opportunities to register to vote. In particular, the secretary has really made a big push on youth engagement. He believes that good habits start early, so we have been doing a project with the colleges called the Ballot Bowl. It's sort of a friendly competition between colleges for registering voters and the student vote, which is the state's first mock election, and we had over 70,000 kids vote in that election, which we were thrilled with. And I just to give you some comparison, that is more than the state of California has in their mock election with 35 million people in the state. So great engagement by our youth, and we think it's really, really important. To give you sort of some sense of kind of the numbers that we're talking about, there's a little over 3.5 million registered voters in the state. Last year, we saw 64.25% voter participation. That is the highest in the country. And I would just remark that we have had the highest voter participation in 9 of the last 10 elections. And so Minnesotans are rightly proud of their engagement and participation in this system, as is the secretary.
Deputy Secretary Spano.
Yes.
What is the resident population for Minnesota of eligible age voters?
I can get that number for you. I don't have it off the top of my head.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As for our administrative team, we handle open appointments. We do official documents. There's a number of administrative pieces. The secretary also serves on the state board of investment and the executive council. And we work with constituents around the state to sort of answer their problems and questions and triage those. The last section would be our Safe at Home program. For those of you who aren't aware of this, this was started in 2006. This is an address confidentiality program that allows people who fear for their physical safety to register their physical home address as our office for all matters, legal and non-legal. And then their mail is sent to us. We then sort their mail and forward it to them, keeping their address separate from public view. This program was started because people frequently ask me, why in the Secretary of State's office? I don't understand why. Isn't that really more of a policing, Department of Public Safety, something like that? And the program started in Washington State when an abuser found his, I don't know if it was his ex-wife or girlfriend, through the voter rolls in that state. And so it was started there and has grown. I think we now have about 35 states around the country that have these programs in them. So it's a much needed program. And I would just note that most of the people who are enrolled in that program are children, enrolled by their, usually their mother, not exclusively, but usually their mother. We do have some judges that are enrolled in this program as well. But by and large, it is women and their children that are enrolled in this program. To give you a sense of kind of what geographies are covered, the area in blue is covered, and the area in gray is also covered. That means the entire state works. We work with the, every county in the state, as well as two directly with two of our tribal communities. We have done outreach to the other ones to engage them. They are covered by the sort of geographic entities in their area, the domestic violence shelters and our other application assistant partners. But White Earth and Mille Lacs have specific people that are dedicated on their staff, tribal staff, to work with us on this. So gives you a sense of that. And then this just is a quick graph that shows how participation in this program has grown over the years. It's a bit of a double-edged sword, as the Secretary would like to say. We would like to see that this program wouldn't be needed, but we're really, really pleased that those people who find that this is something they want to avail themselves of. It's not a panacea, and it's not perfect for everyone, but we are working hard to get word out that this opportunity exists for folks. These are just a few quotes that we have received from people who have been enrolled in our program. I guess I would highlight the first and the fourth, particularly as the first relates to children, the biggest group that is enrolled in our program, and the fourth one, which really sort of lays out the fact that, unfortunately, people do continue to actively seek out to do harm to other folks, and we're really, really thrilled that somebody feels that this program has helped keep them safe. The last piece that I was asked to talk about a little bit is cybersecurity. As relates to the election sphere. So that is my primary, amount of time that I spend in the office. If I was to pick one issue, it is on cybersecurity. In 2015, when the Secretary came into office, one of the early things we realized was that cybersecurity was thought of, as it is in many organizations back then and in some to this day, as a bit of an afterthought, something that you just sort of left to the IT people to figure out how to keep you safe. But starting in 2015, the Secretary decided to create what we call an ITST, an IT security team, which was made up of the IT heads from each one of our divisions, as well as from our infrastructure and networking team, to start thinking much more strategically and deliberately about security in what we do, especially as so many of the things that we do have moved online over the years. Obviously, in 2016, the Russians made efforts around the country to penetrate election systems. They were successful in Illinois, potentially successful in Arizona, depending on how you define success and who you ask. They did engage in scanning behavior on our systems. That is a fairly common practice to identify vulnerabilities. They were not able to, they did not pursue those, any vulnerabilities if they saw any. But we do know that their IP addresses were scanning our systems in 2016, about the same time that they were scanning these other systems. In 2007, in response to that, Jay Johnson, who was then the Department of Homeland Security head for Obama, and then later it was affirmed under the Trump administration to create or place election infrastructure in what is called the critical infrastructure designation, which basically denotes this as something that is of a very high priority nationally for us. Things like the energy grid, nuclear power, transportation, banking, those systems are all designated as critical infrastructure. And along with that came certain protections and services from the Department of Homeland Security, which we have used robustly. To layer on top of things that we've done with the private sector to try and fill in those gaps. I'll wrap up here just by saying, like, in 2017, in response to all of that, Congress released the last $385 million that was available under the Help America Vote Act. 6.6 of that is dedicated to Minnesota. Minnesota is one of five states where that money does not go directly to the election director. It goes to the state, and then the state legislature is required to authorize the Secretary of State, in this case, to use it. We did not receive that authorization last year. We were the only state in the country that did not receive its authorization money. So we continue to work on that. We do not have that authorization now. We are trying to get the full $6.6 million so that we can kind of catch up on what we wanted to do last year. And then looking forward to 2018, what I would sort of suggest is, obviously, that was a national election. Activity around in the cybersphere around elections was less than it was in 2016. I would just suggest that there's a lot of different opinions about why that might have been. In my personal opinion is that I think that folks, not just Russia, but other nations, probably were watching our systems to see what our response was to 2016. The midterm elections are a slightly lower priority target for that sort of work. So that gives you a sense of kind of what we've done around cybersecurity, and I'm happy to answer any questions from the council.
Thank you very much, and for the prompt, good summary. Appreciate that. Questions from council members. Ms. Olson.
Thank you very much. Can you tell us how many employees you have in the office?
I can give you a rough estimate. Yeah. We're in the middle of sort of moving people in and out, but about 85. I can get an exact number for you, though.
No.
Other questions? Mr. Gray, did you have a question? I thought I saw your hand go up earlier. Oh, okay. Over there. Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Berg, Mr. Spano. This is not exactly a question that directly involves the Compensation Council because we're dealing with the high end, but I also work with small cities and have a concern about the number of unfilled elected positions. I'm just curious to know, is that a priority area to address? Has there been changes as far as more and more unfilled, for instance, mayoral, city council positions? Mm-hmm. Is that anything you're tracking?
Tracking, yes. Something that we're actively engaged in, no. I mean, we are responsible for administering the systems that would lead to those. I would imagine that organizations like the League of Minnesota Cities or Minnesota Association of Counties or what have you would be more, you know, there's also a lot of watershed districts and, you know, you can, there's a, Minnesota is, has one of the highest rates of elected officials of all states in the country. It doesn't surprise me that there are some unfilled, but that is, you know, obviously we would love to see those filled, but it's not, doesn't fall under our purview.
Ms. Alton.
One more question about employee salaries. Are employee salaries in the Secretary of State's office limited by the salary of the Secretary of State?
They are driven off of, more so driven off of, well, the Secretary of State's salary obviously is driven off of the governor's. But senior level staff like myself, we fall into what's called the managerial or commissioner's plan. So to the extent that our salaries come from and derive from, in those contracts derive from the governor's salary, but the MAEP and AFSCME contracts are negotiated in those set salaries and sort of lanes and what have you. So,
And so there are people in the Secretary of State's office whose salaries exceed the Secretary?
That is correct.
Yeah.
And in fact, our highest paid employee, last time I checked, is one of our IT people, the head of our IT infrastructure, who oversees our cybersecurity group as well. So,
other questions? I have one for you. Is it in the state system of election security protection? And you said you have IT people from various heads in the Office of Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Do you also deal with the banking people and other folks about their security systems?
Yeah, so the Secretary of State's office participates in a couple of groups that interface with those entities, or one large entity. It's called the MSISAC, the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center. They provide high-level intelligence on what is going on in the critical infrastructure field. So you will get reports from banking and power and transportation and elections. And then there is this one that is specific to elections called the EISAC. And my apologies for all the acronyms, but the Elections Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center. And those folks are specific to elections, but they provide us with a lot of analysis. And to be quite honest with you, I could sit here for an hour and talk only about this, the number of people and entities that we work with and collaborate with. I would say that the most important people in our estimation, in my estimation, to safeguarding the election security of our system are the election judges that serve in communities around this country. Obviously, cybersecurity is very, very important, but those are the folks that are on the front line watching people coming in and out and voting and making sure the tabulators are safe and secured. So the folks at the county level and the city level really play a huge role in that space. But yes, we do collaborate with and get information and intelligence. Some of the intelligence can be very specific to different sectors. Some of it, though, is more broadly shared across all of the various critical infrastructure designations. And I think one of the other things that we have come to find is that and we spend a great deal of time and effort, and I'm very proud of our staff's results in this area when we've been audited by DHS, is that at the individual workstation, all of you as, let's say, employees of the organization, you are the ones that they are going after more frequently than anyone else. What they would love to do more than anything else is to send you a piece of email phishing spyware. Get me to click on something because, let's say, it's benefit enrollments time, and I go in and I click on that, and I give them my username and password. And then they're able to install malware on my desktop, watch my security privileges, see what I have access to on the system, see other people come in and out of my workstation virtually on our network and grab their credentials, and they can sort of move up. So what we have come to really invest a lot of time and effort in is individual training for employees to be able to identify threats and mitigate them quickly. So,
within the cybersecurity field only, would it be accurate to say that the Secretary of State is the lead person or a critical person, or how important is that just within this cybersecurity about elections? I'm quite interested in that.
Well, I would say that we are critically important. Obviously, we have the statewide voter registration system, which is an important piece of data that folks would love to get their hands on. But also understand that the counties play a huge role in this because all of them have access to the statewide voter registration system. So, for example, last year, one of the things that we did was out of our own budget, there was not an allocation for this. We installed what's called multi-factor authentication on the statewide voter registration system. This means that you can no longer just log into the system with a username and password. You have to give another piece of sort of equipment that you can be identified with. In my case, for example, our email at the Secretary of State's office all has multi-factor authentication on it. So when I go to log in remotely into my email system, I get an alert on my phone that asks me to confirm that I did actually try to do that. And so when you say who's critically important, I guess what I would say is, yes, while we may have built the castle, there are 87 doors to the castle. And so everybody has a role to play in it, and it only takes one person making a critical mistake. So we have to be right every single time. Hackers only have to be right, you know, once every couple million times.
Mr. Robbins.
Chair Berg, Mr. Spano, James Robbins, you mentioned the highest paid employee is the IT manager, and I was just curious, I believe the Office of Minnesota IT has the commissioner, mm-hmm. is that $150,000?
Mm-hmm.
Is the IT person higher or lower than that?
In our office?
In your
office. And I don't believe that they are higher than that, no. I didn't bring that piece of information with me. To be clear, I want to make sure that everyone understands, we are not affiliated with Minute. Our IT development team and infrastructure team was separated from Minute many years ago by a previous administration, and it's been that way now for over a decade. So while we do contract some services there, for example, they are the ISP, the internet service provider for our office. They have the state's email system, which we run on. But all of our developers who work on the various applications, the statewide voter registration system, et cetera, are separate from Minute.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Wensler.
Deputy Secretary Spano, thank you for coming today. I appreciate it. I've actually learned a lot, so that was very helpful for a layperson like myself. I don't know if you're aware, but there's three key components that the council looks at when considering what recommendation it'll put out. One is the amount of compensation paid in government service in the private sector and the comparison to it. Two is the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons. And the third is the ability for the state to pay. I'm going to ask the auditor in their next testimony about the state's ability to pay. But the first two questions I have for you, with your permission, is that when you look at the general qualifications for an individual to run for one of the constitutional offices, what are those?
Well, they vary by office. Okay. I should also just say, in the interest of full disclosure, I also serve as an elected official in my home community. Mm-hmm. I'm the mayor of St. Louis Park. So,
Minnesota's sweet spot.
Oh, yay! Thank you. It's working. I'm glad we invested that money. As I tell people, the only thing that you have to have in order to be an elected official is an election certificate.
Okay.
People come with various qualifications, and so I don't know that I can necessarily speak to what are the qualifications for a constitutional officer.
Let me rephrase the question. Okay. I wasn't looking for that kind of a response. I was looking for what are the state's qualifications to be an eligible person to run for office, for constitutional office. Is it just, you said it's the election certificate?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Inference that you took.
I was referring to what you need, to be an elected official. Obviously, all you need to do is win the election. If you're asking for what are the specific qualifications for constitutional office, I can get all of those back to you.
Okay.
I didn't bring them with me, and I don't keep them off the top of my head. So it's,
okay,
versus somebody who could run for, county commissioner or watershed, mm-hmm, district, I want to make sure that if there's differentiation there, I want to make sure that I get that to you. So.
Yes, please. And the second part of my question is that in the data that you're aware of, I know you may not have it available, has there been any lack of those individuals who would meet those expectations to be eligible to get on the ballot to run as a constitutional office in the primaries? Have you seen any lack of candidates running for constitutional office in the primaries? The general election usually has, both sides or three sides, but has the Secretary of State's office seen any constitutional offices have lack or a dearth of candidates that have not run in the primaries?
I can find out exactly how many people have run in each primary for you. We have that data.
Okay.
I don't have a number of how many people have run in primaries. And I can go back, let's say 10 years or something, right, like that, if that's sufficient for you. But I can
just 5 years would be fine.
5 years, okay.
Just in general, just from my knowledge. Has there been any lack of interest in a very...
I don't believe the question is, do we not have people who run for this office?
Yeah.
No, people run for this office.
Okay, and in your estimation, all of the other constitutional offices have the same kind of interest. There's never a lack of candidates.
There has not been a situation where we have not had a candidate for office. That is correct.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions for Mr. Spano? If not, we thank you for your presentation and putting all this together on kind of short notice.
No, that's quite
much
all right.
Much appreciated. And if we have some questions, I take it we can get back to you. And
I have, I think,
come
four
back
or five here,
or
that I'll, okay, I'll circulate back to the breakfast.
All right.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
Then I think we will move right into the state auditor and duties and functions of that office here. And I will let I don't know which one of you wants to begin, but introduce yourself, if you would, and give us a little bit about the background, and away we go.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Legislative Compensation Council. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be here this morning. My name is Donald McFarland, and I am the Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs at the Office of State Auditor Julie Blaha. Again, it's a pleasure to be here, and we're excited to provide you with an overview of the Office of State Auditor. I'm joined by Assistant State Auditor Matt Lindemann, who serves as our Budget, Finance, and Technology Director. State Auditor Julie Blaha began serving as Minnesota's 19th State Auditor on January 7th of this year, and she's asked me to convey her gratitude for your work on the Compensation Council. For the Council's record, State Auditor Blaha has no comments to make regarding compensation for the office. After our presentation, we are happy to take questions, and we'll do our best to answer them. If not, of course, we'll gather up the information and get it back to you. At this time, we'll begin the presentation. We have provided everyone with a handout, and I will also try not to read to you. A few of them may be reading, but for the most part, I'll allow you to do that. Our mission, the mission of the office is to oversee local government finances for Minnesota's taxpayers by helping to ensure financial integrity and accountability in local governmental financial activities. In short, we are and consider ourselves to be the watchdog of Minnesota's taxpayers and their money.
So the office oversees approximately $20 billion in local government spending each year. The office consists of seven divisions. The largest division is our audit practice division. It primarily performs financial and compliance audits of local governments. Annually, it issues approximately 110 reports and approximately 500 single audits. The division provides technical assistance and education to local governments, government finance staff. Its mission is to serve local governments, clients, and the public.
And again, the actions of our office: auditing, reviewing, investigating, reporting, and educating. Okay. I will take a moment, however, to highlight just a little bit of some of our divisions for you. So in the audit division, we're the financial experts on governmental finance. We really view ourselves as independent specialists. Recently, the Department of Human Services reached out to our office to assist them in implementing some new audit standards that they were rolling out. We were excited to help them do that. We were able to guide a major pension fund and their auditors through new roles and rollouts as well. So we're glad to know that we're viewed in that way.
So the next division we have in our office is our TIF division. It oversees expenditures of approximately 1,600 tax increment financing districts in Minnesota. It works to educate TIF authorities in understanding and complying with TIF laws. It notifies TIF authorities of the problems that need to be corrected, and it's funded by a small percentage of tax increment that is captured each year.
So as Matt just said, a very small portion of the tax increment that is collected is what is used to fund the oversight of TIF in Minnesota through our office. $10.8 million of tax increment was returned to cities and counties and school districts last year, and we believe that was because of our early intervention. Despite that number, fewer actually reported. We look at that as a good thing. We think that TIF districts are running very well, very accurately and efficiently, and doing what they're supposed to be doing, so that there aren't nearly as many as could be when it comes to incidents of tax increment that needs to be returned. But again, education efforts, early communications between TIF districts and our office often eradicate that problem, and they certainly increase efficiency in these districts.
Our Government Information Division collects and reviews and reports on financial information from over 3,300 local governments in Minnesota. GID is the primary source of information to the state legislature, U.S. Census Bureau, other state and local entities, researchers, and the public. It works closely with local governments to help them comply with their legal compliance report or legal reporting requirements.
So CTAS, you can think of it as QuickBooks for government and local units of government. We designed this system a few years back. How many years?
Originally, it was designed in 1990.
So the state auditor's office designed this program to assist local units of government in reporting their financial information to us. Again, it's QuickBooks for local government. Currently, there are over 1,440 entities that are using it, so we're excited about that. I will say that in the office next to mine is one of my office in the Government Information Division, and in the office next to mine is the gentleman that responds to calls that come into our office every day with questions, and I can tell you he doesn't hang up the phone all day. He's the hardest working man I've ever worked next door to, and I've been there a couple of months, and he's on the phone all day every day, and I have yet to hear anything that doesn't sound like a very, very satisfied local unit of government when we're helping them.
So our pension division oversees approximately 600 local public pension plans throughout the state. These plans are mostly made up of fire relief associations that support volunteer firefighters. It is a vital resource to trustees of these plans. The division's resources responds to thousands of questions each year on a wide range of pension topics.
I'd like to highlight the Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group. So our office convenes this working group. It's a team of firefighters, pension managers, representatives of smaller units of government, other stakeholders. And we do this on a regular basis. Their work has included extending benefits to emergency medical service personnel, but it also works on the pension bills that we see the legislature pass when it comes to the Volunteer Relief Fire Associations. We're in the process of a bill now. It was heard just last week. There will be a second hearing, and we're hopeful that this bill will be passed and included in the omnibus pension bill as session moves forward.
Our legal special investigation division provides legal support for all of the OSA. It also investigates allegations of theft and misuse of public funds in local governments. When appropriate, it coordinates with local government law enforcement and reports findings to the local government prosecutors. The division works proactively to safeguard public dollars by educating public and local government officials.
I'll point out, while there have been one or two in the news recently, I'll mention the Bemidji Events Center, what was referred as sort of a phantom vendor scheme, which is something we're seeing more and more of at the state auditor's office as a direct result of more and more money access cards being distributed to staff and employees and contractors. The vendors are set up. You're using, you can pay on your phones now, so you set up one to pay the other. These phantom vendor schemes we've seen in a few places, but we did see it in Bemidji. The net result of the investigation that we provided, and we work with law enforcement on these types of matters, but we uncovered $110,000 in improper and or questionable uses of that money. Our next role when it comes to this is to communicate to local governments how we think they can do better moving forward and how we can help them improve their standards and their rules and for rules and regulations, which we did in Bemidji. They have and they did change some practices as a result. And in this case, and as in some others, A prosecution seems pretty likely of the individual that was serving as the event coordinator for Bemidji.
The last two divisions in our office is the Constitutional Division and the Operations Management Division. The Constitutional Division provides the overall leadership of for the OSA and fulfills the constitutional duties of the office. The division consists of the state auditor and her staff. The Operations Management Division supports the day-to-day operations of the entire office. It provides the office management, accounting, technology services necessary to allow the other divisions to accomplish their goals.
Just a word on the Constitutional Division of the State Auditor's Office. We are one lean machine. So the Constitution Office is the state auditor, 40% of myself, and 25% of our general counsel. So that's it. So we like to think we're running a pretty lean and tight ship over there. I'd like to highlight also an area where a few people realize where the state auditor state auditor is in some of the roles that she performs, and that's on the boards that that she represents Minnesotans on. The State Board of Investment, Deputy Secretary Spano mentioned that as well. The Secretary of State sits on this. You know, they oversee $90.2 billion of our investment money. The Public Employee Retirement Association, you know, PARA, there are 110,000 members currently receiving benefits through PARA. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, in 2018, they invested $1.26 billion and assisted 766,000 Minnesota households find homes. Pretty impressive numbers. The state auditor also sits on the Minnesota Executive Council, the Minnesota Land Exchange Board, and the Rural Finance Authority. Speaking of the Rural Finance Authority, as you may have heard, the disaster loan program has proposed changes as they relate to some of our winter weather issues. A bill was passed just last week by the House and the Senate, and it's on its way to the governor's desk this morning, I believe. For his signature. The bill allows for the Rural Finance Authority Board to be the ones that declare the emergency. Previously it was the feds or the governor. The types of emergency have also been expanded here to include the weight of snow, sleet, and ice. And as we saw barn roofs collapsing recently, it's great for rural Minnesota that this bill was passed and that the governor intends to sign it. And later today, we think the Rural Finance Authority will have a call and start to get that money out to farmers throughout Minnesota who so desperately need it, given the weather conditions. Just to wrap up, and then we'll open the floor for questions, should you have any. Again, you know, the impact of our office, you know, we ensure that local government funds are used for the purposes they're intended for. We want to be sure that local governments hold themselves to the highest standards of financial accountability. And again, I'll close where I started, and that's we do view ourselves really as the watchdog for Minnesota's taxpayers. We thank you for the opportunity to make a presentation on our office. We're proud of it, and we're certainly able to take some questions. If we can't, for some reason, get you an answer today, we'll certainly do that in the near future.
Thank you very much for your testimony and come here. It's helpful to us to understand things a little bit better. Are there any questions from council members? Ms. Olson?
Yes. Thank you for all the information you provided. Can you tell us how many employees there are in the state auditor's office, number one, and number two, are their salaries limited by the state auditor's salary?
So currently, I believe the number is 79 employees. I believe there are a couple auditor positions that we're currently filling, so that could go up a couple, but I believe it's 79. Regarding the salary, they are not limited to the salary of the state auditor's salary.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Naden? Rubens, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Chair Berg, how many employees, if any, are at a higher level than the auditor? And the other question I guess I would have is, has there been a change in the number of employees related to the changes in provisions related to county audits, and what is the status of that situation? Do you want to take the first part of that?
Mr. Chairman, member, you know, I'm not really sure. There's at least one employee I know that has a salary larger, higher than the state auditors, but I'm not sure how many would have that. So.
And then your follow-up question?
Had to do with whether there have been a fewer number of auditors because of the county situation. I'll let you summarize what's happened legally.
Sure. There. So we are doing fewer county audits than historically, in part to the legislation that was passed a couple years ago that allowed counties to go to a local firm, private audit firm, for their audits. I think that through attrition, there are and have been less auditors on staff working. I will tell you that we're hoping to keep open these open positions and keep them keep giving ourselves the ability to fill them should the work come back. We audit more than just counties. But yeah, I would say that mostly due to attrition, some have just gone unfilled as a result of less counties that are being audited.
Thank you. Any other questions, Mr. Asp?
Hi, thank you. Just to follow up on that quickly, you said there are 79 employees currently. How many have there been in past years? Do you know?
There, I think if we were to look back to Auditor Dutcher's administration, I believe there were 145 employees during Auditor Dutcher's administration. I think that number started to, I shouldn't say I think it did, it started to drop during Auditor Awada's administration. There was a sort of across-the-board cut of state staff that was required, and so there was sort of a drop there, and then a slow fall of number after that.
And then following up on Mr. Robbins' other question, do you know how many, every county is required to have an audit every year, is that right?
Yes.
And
I say yes maybe too quickly. It's my understanding they do, but I mean, yeah. Okay, thank you. They do.
And I was in the statute, I think. How many of Minnesota's 87 counties use a private audit firm?
So I believe we do approximately, I'm going to say 40 counties. So it's a little more than half that are using a private audit firm. I think I want to say 55 to 60%.
Do you have a sense of how that compares with previous years? I mean, in terms of when it wasn't required to do for every county to have an audit, how many your office would do?
Go ahead.
So under Auditor Dutcher's administration and prior to Auditor Wada's, the office did 86 of the 87 counties.
Every year.
During Auditor Wada's administration up until the change in the statute, we were doing approximately 58 to 60 counties. And with the change in the statute, we've had a few counties that every 2 years they need to notify us on a two-year basis. So they give us about a year and a half pre-notice, and then we've lost a few each. So we've had two cycles, I think, since the law went into effect, and we've lost a few each time.
Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Mr. Gregory.
Thank you, gentlemen. I confess that before today I knew less about your office's work than I should, and I also don't know much about the individuals who have served as state auditor. And I wonder if you could just give us a brief summary of the professional background of Auditor Blaha, and if you could also comment on the prior two auditors, that would be great.
Auditor Blaha is a math teacher, a middle school math teacher. She lives in Anoka and Ramsey, and she was a teacher at Jackson Middle School. So middle school math, imagine. She most recently, before becoming auditor, was the secretary-treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. So that treasurer role I think helped her very well and serves her very well in her current role. But she's a math teacher. Auditor Otto served for 12 years, was prior to becoming the state auditor, was a legislator for I think one or two terms, a short period of time, and then became the state auditor where she served for 12 years. Prior to that, Padawada Anderson was prior to that for 4 years. I'm not too familiar with Auditor Awada, and prior to that was Dutcher. We can keep going back to Governor Dayton and Governor Carlson, a lot of governors. A lot of auditors became governors back in the day, and a lot of auditors wanted to be governor back in the day. So that's a little bit of history.
Thank you.
Sir, thank you. Sir. Any other questions by council members?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Wensler.
Director McFarland, I apologize. You may or may not know this off the top of your head, and I was wondering if you happen to know if the state does have a deficit and or if the state has a, other than a deficit, if it's got a running tally of more funds going out versus funds coming in. Because one of the tasks we have is number three under our charter is the state's ability to pay if we were to recommend raises, and I didn't know if the auditor's office was a good office to ask for that particular data. Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Mr. Chair, Mr. Wensler. I do not know the answer to that question, but let me look, and we'll get back.
Ms. Olson, maybe.
If I might, the state constitution requires a balanced budget. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but there's
not
a deficit.
Okay.
Any other questions for the folks from the auditor's office? If not, we thank you very much for coming and for your presentation and educating a lot of us about a lot of things here. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everyone.
And then we're going to just keep right on going here, I think, and move right into the Judicial Selection Commission presentation. This is a follow-up to the excellent discussion we had last session about judicial salaries and candidates for judgeships. And the people here, Judicial Selection Commission people, were very helpful and worked some over the weekend, I know, to get this together, which is much appreciated by all of us.
Well, thank you for noting the late-minute request. Helps us certainly set expectations.
Well, we appreciate your being here, and why don't you just jump right in, and I'm sure we'll have some questions for you after
Absolutely.
You get done.
Well, my name is Lola Velasquez Aguilu, and I'm currently the chair of the Judicial Selection Commission appointed by Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan. And I have brought with me Jesse Bethke Gomez, who served on the commission under Governor Dayton for 8 years as a non-attorney at-large member appointed by the Supreme Court. And I thought his presence here today would be helpful in responding to perhaps some of the questions that you all might have looking back over the last 8 years. My hope for this morning is to give you a little bit of an overview regarding the commission, how it functions, and myself, and then to turn it over to Mr. Bethke Gomez so that he can similarly give you a little bit of his background and some of his insights and reflection on some of the questions that you've asked. So as I mentioned, I'm currently the chair of the commission. I previously served the commission for 3 years, appointed by the Supreme Court. The commission is comprised of attorneys and non-attorneys, or 49 members, including myself. And there are at-large members, as Mr. Bethke Gomez was, who serve the entire state. And then there are district members who specifically evaluate candidates only in those judicial districts. And as I mentioned, they are attorneys as well as non-attorneys. These individuals serve in a voluntary capacity, which is to say that we are not employed by the commission. In fact, my day job is that I'm a lawyer at Medtronic. I was previously an assistant U.S. attorney. Before that, I worked at Dorsey & Whitney, and I also clerked for two judges. The responsibilities and objectives of the commission are set out in Minnesota Statute 480B.01, and that was enacted into law in 1990. This statute charges the commission with soliciting and reviewing applicants, with interviewing candidates, and recommending finalists to the governor for appointment to vacancies on the district trial courts and the workers' compensation courts of appeals. Governor Dayton has had previously used the commission to make recommendations regarding Court of Appeals appointments and Supreme Court appointments, and Governor Walz has indicated his intent to do the same. So I'd like to emphasize today the work that the commission does to recruit candidates, which is perhaps one of the most important functions of the commission. The statute specifically provides that the commission shall actively seek out and encourage qualified individuals, including women and minorities, to apply for judicial offices. And I think, as you've heard from some of the other individuals who have come before this body, that this recruitment piece, it has become increasingly difficult. And there are potentially a variety of reasons for this. Governor Dayton appointed now more than 55% of the existing judiciary. So there was huge turnover in the past 8 years. And when something like that happens, it necessarily makes our ability to continue going out and recruiting candidates more challenging. And so that's certainly one issue that we face and continue to face. The challenge in greater Minnesota, I can tell you anecdotally, we do feel though as though that has become increasingly difficult as well. And part of that, for the feedback that we've received from judges and within the communities, is that the work that we are asking our judges to do is increasingly harder. Not just because the volume has increased, but because we are more regularly looking to our judiciary to come up with creative solutions to judging and to the problems that our community face, whether that's through implementing community programs and specialty courts, or the way that they're dealing with reentry into the, from the criminal justice system. And that work comes with a significant emotional toll, as you can imagine. That is difficult work to do. You're seeing the very difficult challenges that the families in Minnesota and individuals from across our state bring before our courts. It's particularly hard in many ways for judges in greater Minnesota, where they, in order to do the work that they do, have to set up important barriers between them and the remaining portions of the community, whether that's within the bar or elsewhere. And they have to do that with fewer colleagues on the bench, right? So we may have individuals who we're asking to serve in a county where they might be the only judge. It's a very different experience than our judges, for example, in Hennepin County, who have a very large collegial body from which to seek support. We would note that there has been a theme in our recruitment of individuals who express concern regarding pay. And although we don't have statistics to offer you as to this point, we can only tell you about some of the conversations we've had. There have been instances where we've seen individuals who could have served longer deciding to leave the bench in order to go out and make more money, and that's certainly true in greater Minnesota. Where we have these challenges in recruitment, we certainly don't want to see pay become a more significant barrier to the bench. One of the priorities for the commission, as we mentioned, is to recruit and recommend a diverse bench. That is as true for gender, racial, ethnic diversity as it is for professional diversity. It's important that our judges understand the challenges that civil litigants bring, as well as they understand the challenges that criminal defendants and victims will face before the courts. And so it continues to be a priority for the commission that we go out and recruit applicants from both the private sector and the public sector. Now, to this end, there's a whole host of efforts that we undertake to try to bring in applicants to the bench. We work very closely with different bar organizations, from the Hispanic Bar Association to the Black Lawyers, the Lavender Bar, including the Minnesota State Bar Association, both to make their members aware of the process as well as to identify potential future vacancies. Governor Dayton hosted several judicial recruitment summits in order to build relationships across all sectors of the bar, specifically identifying the organizations that were working to recruit and to thank them for their work with the hope that they would then continue those efforts. When we have become aware of potential vacancies, we have gone out proactively to try to line up applicants. So, for example, in 2016, we learned that the Iron Range bench, made up of 3 judges in Virginia and 2 in Hibbing, would completely turn over by 2019 to 2020. And so then Chair Lee Sheehy and Andrew Olson attended the 2017 Iron Range Bar Association annual dinner, and there they presented regarding the process to apply for the bench with the hope that they could start conversations so that individuals would apply 3 years down the road. And it's that kind of forward-looking engagement that we have to be continually participating in. We're currently partnering with the Minnesota State Bar Association to do events across the state, in Rochester, in St. Cloud, in Duluth. And what we'll do at those events, we will go, we will offer information about how to be notified of vacancies, about how to apply, what the commission considers, so people can have more information about the process. I have also been, since I've become chair, having conversations every week with a different chief judge from each of the districts to better understand what are the needs going to be in terms of vacancies over the course of the next 4 years, and how can the commission help identify potential applicants now. One of the things we've always done is made commissioners like myself and Mr. Becky Gomez available to meet with applicants who might be interested. This kind of one-on-one engagement has been very important to the process. You know, the last thing that I will say, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Becky Gomez, and of course, be happy to answer any questions, is, and I think that we all know this, there are a lot of reasons why lawyers answer the call to serve, right? I mean, the judiciary in many ways for people represents a tremendous opportunity to give back. And there are personal rewards beyond that in terms of flexibility, not trying cases anymore, frankly, I'm sure for some is alluring as well. But pay has never been one of those things, right? I mean, we don't see individuals who go to the judiciary because of the pay. But we also need it to not be a barrier. And so that's why, when asked, we decided to come here today. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Becky Gomez.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gomez, and then we'll circle back with
thank
questions
for both. It's a pleasure to be here. I was appointed by the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2011 and 2015. I did serve two terms as a volunteer. Stepping back, I think what's important is that thinking about Minnesota government and Minnesota in terms of democracy, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, those three all are independent, yet they need to work together. And it, I think, was my experience showed that they, in fact, do work very well together. Throughout the course of the last 8 years, one of the questions that I would always ask the chief judges in the 10 districts is, how are families faring? And not necessarily what's the quality of their journey through the court system, but through the court system, those are indicators for how families are faring. And the chief judges would say, ah, okay, I understand what you're saying. What I started to benchmark, though, anecdotally, and not with empirical evidence, is a number of things. One, an increase in concerns and interests in candidates with family law background. Throughout the 8 years, I saw a market increase, as much in greater Minnesota, for the need to recruit candidates that have a background in family law. We saw increases in the data on chip cases. I think those are important. And thinking about the, as Lola has said, the concerns about specialty courts, there are more pressures on the judge in today's environment than ever before. I have the sense that families are not faring well. The opioid crisis, issues of domestic violence, issues facing children and families are very real. And our courts, impressively, are really profound in how they think about that as a delivery model of the criminal justice system, as well as in for civil courts. But I think those are pressures in greater Minnesota. I think in our time looking at the larger districts, the second district, which is in the Ramsey area, or the fourth district, which is in Hennepin County area, and then I think of other districts in the seventh district and the eighth district, the one court room exists, and they are there in Minnesota. Yet, so that person's going to be placed there. They really have to reach out in their own networks. There's a lot of pressure on judges. And I think, you know, the backdrop is this. During the last 8 years, the at-large members, I understand, We reviewed 2,750 applications. We interviewed approximately 1,000 candidates. The governor, I believe, placed 182 to 188 judicial appointments from the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Workers' Compensation, Tax Court, and then the 10 district courts as well. I think we should be proactive in thinking about your charge for what you're concerned about as a council from the standpoint, can we recruit and retain the very best so that for the judicial portion of Minnesota's government is strong and sound? We need a strong bench because the issues facing Minnesotans are very significant. I think the trend line is that families are not doing better, not because of an administration, just because the issues facing Minnesota are quite real. I'd also say that the trend line for us in Minnesota is changing. For instance, what does the next 10 years look like for us? Well, we know currently there is approximately 685,000 people today in Minnesota who are age 65 and above. That the last 10 years, there have been a contribution to this population by 235,000 people, which is more than the last four decades combined. 10,000 people a day across America are turning age 65, and by 2030, Minnesota, according to the State Demographics Office, age 65 and above population in Minnesota will be approximately 1,262,000 people. What does that mean for Minnesota government? How does that begin to change the executive branch, our thinking, the legislative branch, the concern, and judicial branch in the administering of justice and fairness and applying the law? I think those are the backdrops that are there, and I think for that intersectionality and through line to the areas that you're concerned about recruitment, about, you know, retention, about market competition, and can Minnesota pay for it? I would also argue we can't afford not to pay for it because we need a strong bench, and that's in the best interest of Minnesota as well. And those are my comments as well.
Thank you both very much. That was very helpful. We heard from the District Judges Association at the last meeting, and that precipitated a lot of this discussion about trend lines and who's applying and so on and so forth. And there are five of us on the council, at least, who are lawyers, and a number of us, I think probably all of us, have been in a number of courtrooms over the years and one thing or another, and appreciate the need for a strong judiciary. So appreciate that very much. And Councilman, Mr. Gregory.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm one of the five attorneys that Chairman Berg referred to, so I am very appreciative not only of your time here, but also the work that you do. We learned during our last meeting that the judiciary is asking for a 3.5% increase for judicial salaries, along with some other increases for staff and so forth. And I understand the District Judges Association is asking for a 5% increase. So I have a two-part question. The first is whether you have a perspective on what a number would be that would satisfy some or address some of the concerns that you've expressed about the ability to attract and retain judicial candidates. And then the second part of that question is whether your council has communications with the judiciary about what you're seeing at the recruitment level and the need to make sure that salary doesn't become a barrier to retaining or attracting qualified candidates.
So as to your first question, it's really outside of the purview of the commission to make a recommendation regarding the amount of compensation or the increase. So unfortunately, I can't give you a number there. In terms of what the communications we have with the judges and the judiciary, we absolutely have very regular communications with the members of the bench. As I mentioned before, every week I have a call with a different chief judge from one of the district courts across the state. We're in regular contact with, I am certainly in regular contact with Chief Justice Gilday, and I'll be sitting down in a couple weeks with our chief judge from the Court of Appeals, Judge Cleary. Part of the reason why we do that is because In one part, they see the people in their courts who should become judges, right? So the lawyers who are appearing before them who may have an interest. So for us, they're an incredibly useful tool to identify talent. And in the same way, then, we might reach out to those judges and say, you know, we know you're mentoring a certain lawyer, and we've had conversations with this person. We think they're having concerns about applying, and they're on the fence. Might you have a conversation? So it's a very collaborative relationship that we have. Does the topic of pay come up? It does come up. I mean, particularly when we are trying to recruit lawyers away from law firms. I mean, where the salary is so far from what a judicial salary is. So in so many ways there, the pitch that we have to make to those lawyers is very tailored toward the other reasons and benefits that come from serving the judiciary. But it's a different calculation every time.
Thank you.
Ms. Olson.
Thank you for coming today and for giving us additional information. One of the concerns that has been raised by one of our members who wasn't able to be here today is about workload and workload distribution. Now, it's my understanding that that is really the business of the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice decides what the allocations are. But is that a concern of your applicants, and is there a sense that some of the judicial jobs are easy and finished by Wednesday afternoon? That's one of the comments.
Boy, I think that anybody who's, first of all, one of the things that we do when we're evaluating candidates, that we always hope to understand how much research and diligence they've done regarding the job, because we don't want to put someone in a position where they are going to be completely surprised by the humanity that will come before them. Mm-hmm. And it's not an or by the workload. No, I mean, we want to make sure people understand no one comes to the judiciary for a 9-to-5 job, right? And so we routinely would ask questions and do ask questions during the interview process to make sure that applicants understand that. Anyone who would come before the commission and suggest that they were looking for a balance that would allow them to leave at 4 o'clock and be done for the week on a Wednesday would most certainly not make it beyond that round. Because we are very sensitive to the work that our judges are having to do and the way that the collegiality that's required. I mean, one of the things that chief judges always tell us is they need team players. Why? Because if something happens in one judge's life such that they might have to be out for a day, the court can't stop. It cannot grind to a halt. So we need other individuals who can pick up the load. It is significant. I think there may have been a time where people thought that they could just gradually progress toward the bench with the hope that it was an easier road forward. But judging is very hard work. It's particularly hard work in the climate and environment in which we live today. And again, that's not just because of the volume, although the volume is hugely significant. It's also the nature of the work and the nature of lawyering in this day and age.
I'd like to add, if I can, to that comment as well, is that we would often see, and to this day you see, candidates who will job shadow, who mm-hmm. will spend time, you know, that whole day out, and that's important.
So can you just explain that to the group?
Let me explain that.
Yeah.
What candidates can call a judge and say, you know, I'd like to learn more about this, and judges are very available. We found throughout the entire state of Minnesota, judges are very, very available to say, yes, come spend the day with me and, you know, let's go, you could job shadow what my day is like. And, you know, the candidates who are prepared have talked with a number of judges. They've done the job shadowing. And so they have an understanding to the point of it's, 9-to-4 or 8-to-4. They have a real good understanding. I wanted to pivot to this point, though, about this as well. This gets back to the point that people do make that sacrifice to become a judge for the greater good, for the common good, and a sense of public service. What I think we have to think about is, for Minnesota's judiciary, how do we be the best stewards of that time, talent, and treasury that we need to assure that we have a strong bench for Minnesotans? So I would, you know, frame that question in that way.
Mr. Chair, may I do a follow-up question?
Yes, continue.
Another question raised is the ability of judges to supplement their judicial salaries by doing other work. Can you comment on that? No, that's not something you deal with directly.
It's not. I mean, and frankly, it's not something that people have ever asked us about. Yeah. You know, once they're on the bench, that's sort of like we've sent them off into the universe, and so we no longer. I mean, we certainly have a hope that we can select people who know what they're getting into so that they will stay there, right? We want folks, the governor wants to appoint individuals who are committed to a long career on the judiciary, as opposed to folks who are going to come in and then 3 years later decide it's not the right fit. Because there's a lot that the judiciary puts into training new judges and getting them up to speed to the point where they actually can contribute at the level of some of the more senior members of the bench.
Other question, Mr. Asp. Thanks. Then we'll get to this end of the room here.
Okay. Thank you, and thanks to both of you for your service. It's I know it's a volunteer job, and it's a huge benefit to the state, so thank you for doing it. I have a couple questions. You mentioned the number 2,750 applicants. Was that, I'm sorry, could you say the time period that was over?
Yeah, the past 8 years.
Past 8 years?
When I was first appointed, according to the governor's office, Governor Dayton's office, it was 2,750 applications that we reviewed at the at-large level. There were nine of us, two appointed by the Supreme Court, and then seven appointed by the governor during the past 8 years. It's 4 years per term, total of 8 years.
And does the commission or the governor's office keep track of how many applicants there are for each judicial district?
Yes,
when there's an open seat?
Yeah.
And could we see that information?
I wouldn't have access to that.
I'm sure we could follow up with the governor's office and ask them.
It'd be great if we could see that.
So you'd like to know the breakdown of number of applicants per judicial district?
When there's a vacancy,
over
right.
Over the past 8 years?
Well, it could be less than that. It could be 4 years or even a couple years. Yeah, I mean, what I'm getting at is, you know, we've heard about the disparity in pay and the difficulty in finding applicants. And part of what I'm wondering is whether there's a disparity in the number of applicants in every judicial district. So, for example, if you get a lot more applicants in the 4th Judicial District than you might in the 10th. That's kind of what I'm curious about. And then I'm also wondering if you track how many people, sitting judges, leave the position before the mandatory retirement age of 70.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that was outside of the scope of the commission itself in terms of tracking that, but I'll defer to the chair.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we'd have to go back through and look at each vacancy and then sort of work backwards to identify the reason for that vacancy. Yeah. So those numbers don't currently exist in the way that they could be pulled together easily.
Okay. Thank you.
I noticed that Judge Jasper and I think is here from the District Judges Association. I don't know if they have any information about that. We'll take a break and maybe we can see if they can shed a little more light along those lines. Well, Mr. Evenson.
Thank you for your time and your service. Just a couple questions. How many of these positions are filled versus by recruiting versus applicants through, I guess, the vacancies that are posted, I think, on the governor's site, at least Dayton's site, they were posted there?
You know, that's not something that we keep track of in terms of identifying what brought this person in the door. But I can tell you that for every vacancy, the commission actively recruits. So, and be mindful of the fact that it's an ongoing process that's not always responsive specific to a vacancy because there are certain rules that kick in. When there's a vacancy that's been announced, we ask applicants not to have any contact with commissioners so as to not influence the process. So that's why it's extremely important for the work that we do, that we're recruiting everywhere on an ongoing basis, and that we are engaging other members of the community who can sort of fill the void once we can no longer have direct conversations with applicants.
And then how does the commission go about recruiting candidates that are able to handle both criminal and civil? I worked in the 9th District for Judge Marvin, and he handled everything, where I know now in like the 4th District and others, they have like civil calendars, so they can specialize a little more. But how do you guys go about doing that?
Let me mention that throughout the entire state of Minnesota, what you often will find that with someone might be in a county attorney's office, but they had a civil background, or you find that someone has a strong civil background and they need to learn criminal law, we would find that balance. We're guided by the guidance of each of the chief judges as well, and we'd also look at that how fast can a person learn another area of law, for instance, family law? So those are all the great questions. You look for the breadth, the scope, the particular needs of the bench. How does that particular opportunity fit with their portfolio of people in there as well? So it's an important consideration. But we also looked at how well people were prepared in a particular field of law and examples of the past of how they've learned other areas of law to strengthen their ability to serve as a judge.
Thank you.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, and thank you for your service, Chair Velasquez and Mr. Bethke. I have a kind of a two-part question. One is, do we still have a system where judicial retirees provide fill-in services, and are they restricted to the district they were elected in? And the second part of that is, and this is a follow-up from our last meeting, I realize you are restricted for recruitment within your district, but I still have to question whether there's really a constitutional prohibition as long as a appointee establishes residency prior to election. So is there any interest in your experience in folks transitioning from one district to another to expand the applicant field?
So let's see, that's a really interesting question. And it's something that I wouldn't want to, I don't think that I would feel equipped to answer today. It's something we've started talking about more and more. But in just some of the early conversations I've had with some of the district court chief judges, you know, when you're asking someone to go out into a community where they haven't lived, I think that there has been some of that done in the past. Because remember, you know, you just have to be from the district. And our districts, some of them are quite large. So you could live in one county and be traveling 2 hours to the courthouse where you're going to serve. And over the long term, I think that's been particularly challenging. I think we've seen that people get burned out, both as to the travel and for a whole host of not feeling supported in the local community in which they're serving. There's a lot of reasons why, although that's probably the closest analog. I mean, you're talking now about pulling people from other districts and bringing them in, so reaching out even farther. I would have to say I can certainly see why we might get to a point where we have to consider that. I would say I don't believe personally that that's an ideal situation. You know, we do, I think, need judges who understand the needs of the micro communities in which they serve. We need people who are accessible, right? So imagine if a judge isn't actually living there. We need someone who's available to sign a warrant at midnight there in that county. And I don't know how that would work if the closest judge is living 3 hours away.
I don't want this to get too far afield here, but your group thought some, or have you had discussions about changing of the judicial district boundaries to alleviate some of those kinds of problems?
It's most certainly outside of our wheelhouse, not a conversation.
Okay, I understand.
If I can add a couple things too about this. Think about Minnesota communities and those districts. What I will say is that some of the districts, as the chair has mentioned, you know, they're traveling great distances. It's the frequency of travel, you know, during rain, during snow. I mean, I can't imagine what February was like. But they do travel, and in many ways, Minnesota's judges are unsung heroes for the service that they do, for needing to be where they are on a regular frequency, how they do with what they can. I also wanted to mention that early on, I was proud of our commission of reaching out for diverse candidates, and I was a strong promoter for us to do that for the entire sense of what diversity means in Minnesota. And my understanding is that Governor Dayton had appointed 100% increase in diverse judicial appointments during the past 8 years. We need to be thinking about diverse appointments and greater Minnesota at the same time. And my hope would be that we would also see greater diverse appointments in greater Minnesota as well.
Any other questions? Mr. Robbins.
I'll just make one comment regarding, I do understand the geographical issues, but what I have perceived are folks who've come into the cities and been very good attorneys, but they've come from greater Minnesota communities, and they have kept their connections to those communities over time. They may have maintained a cabin where they grew up. And I think you might find, if you did the survey, that there is interest in returning. They may be an older, they may be in their 50s, but that would create some diversity to the court as well, new older appointees.
And so, I appreciate your comment. What I would just say to that is, as I indicated, this is not something that we've really kicked around, frankly. It's not something that I've discussed with the governor. It's not even something I've discussed with the chief judge.
I would say some of that maybe the judicial council can deal with some of that. I think it's an interesting question. Ms. Olson.
Well, so I just want to follow up and drive down a little bit further on that. So if a candidate from Minneapolis came in and applied for Polk County, whatever district that is, would you consider that applicant with...
So under Governor Dayton, I think there was the requirement that the applicant reside or have a residence in the district.
Okay.
And I don't recall if that comes from the governor's preference or if that's a rule that comes from some other source.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
It is something that we continue to discuss with Governor Walz.
Mr. Wensler.
Mr. Chairman, I want to appreciate and say thank you to Chair Velasquez and Member Betke Gomez. I appreciate both of you being here today. I have several questions, and I'll try to be pithy and as quick as possible. In your opinion, and I don't know which one of you wishes to answer the question, has there been or is there one group that there has been a lack or a larger volume of reduced candidates, either on the district level, the appeals level, or the Supreme Court level? Where would you say that the larger quantity of dearth of candidates is?
Are you talking geographically or in terms of racial, ethnic?
No, just the level. For example, district would be the trial level, and you've got appeals, Supreme Court, et cetera. Where do you think the largest need is for, because you'd want diversity on every level, but where's the largest need that the commission is focusing on recruiting for? Is it usually the district level, the more trial level?
It is the district court level.
Okay. And then just in generic terms, as best as you can, because I'm a layperson rather than an attorney, could you tell me in generic terms what your commission looks for as a qualified, quote-unquote, individual when you're looking? I know there's a huge list, I'm sure. But in general, what are the knowledge, skills, and abilities you look for a talented judiciary candidate?
Yes, absolutely. We look for judicial temperament, a sense of constitution, that sense of how people treat one another. We look for, clearly, education, experience, their background, very specific areas of law that they've been involved in, that their practice.
Mm-hmm.
We also look more broadly at what I would call life experience. What is it that they bring to the bench? Counsel Wensler, I too am a non-attorney, so I spent a lot of time, my first year or two, asking a lot of judges, tell me what you would look for.
Mm-hmm.
And so the commission would look at these overall, knowledge, skills, and abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the arc of what we're looking for is a sense of call to serve, public service, and then, this broader sense of life experience. How does that inform a person working with pro se litigants, which is on the rise? So those are some of the basic categories that we would
In a nutshell, from your perspective, if I may, sir, what is the primary cause from your observations for turnover on the district level?
I don't know about turnover. What the commission is driven by is once a vacancy is announced, there's statutorily 60 days from the time of the vacancy to mm-hmm. fill that position. The governor has to appoint a position. So a colleague of mine who, in our era, she lived in greater Minnesota, she put over 20,000 miles
mm-hmm.
on her car. I don't think we had the time to entertain those kinds of questions because the pace of the commission on the recruitment, on review, on interviewing, that flow of what we were involved in and with the current commission under Chairperson Velasquez is really quite intensive.
Then I'll just open it up to both of you. I know that I've said this question, but I'll try to rephrase it. Is it mostly because the third district court judges are hitting the retirement age of mandatory, or is it because there are vacancies that are caused by something other than the mandatory retirement age? Let me rephrase the question.
Thank you for the clarity. Retirement age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, in your opinion, do you believe that, or what organization or what group of professionals did you believe would be a comparison for a skill set? Because one of the items we're supposed to look at is how the compensation is paid, and then we need to compare it to someone that's similar in the private sector. Do you think it'd be arbitrators? Do you think it'd be mediators? Who do you think in the private sector would be as close as possible for comparison that we could use as a comparison for salaries and wages compared to district judges?
In terms of comparison of skills?
Yes.
I can tell you that when we're recruiting, we are going to look for, if we're going to go to the law firms, we're mostly looking at very senior lawyers, if not partners. Mm-hmm. If we're looking for private practitioners, we're solo practitioners. They're typically people who have held a practice for a long time. There have been instances where people have become judges around 10 years of experience, but it's the rare occasion. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably more often that someone has had around 20 to 25 years of experience before they're coming to the bench, and we've got people who have certainly had more than that. We certainly had some who've had less. But you can imagine, even if they're in the public sector, if I think about some of the folks we've recruited from different county attorney's office or the U.S. Mm-hmm. attorney's office, we've recruited a lot of people who have been in management positions within those organizations. We have recruited lawyers who have been in management or leadership positions within nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Chair Velasquez, I appreciate that. And I apologize. I might have said the question wrong, and I apologize for that. And I am pushing you a little bit. But as I understand, when we look at the judges that sit on the bench, they have the different skill that you've mentioned that the commission and that the judiciary trains them into, to go from being an attorney looking out for one party to then being an objective observer to then make the best ruling possible based upon the law and the evidence that's presented before them. So I apologize. If you were to take attorneys, which I know will be very difficult, and you were to separate that group as a pending group of qualified individuals for the legal aspect, what skilled group of individuals who would match closer to adjudicators? That's why I looked at mediators or arbitrators. Is there another group that might be a good comparison for adjudicators, those who have to make decisions between disputing parties?
You know, I appreciate the question that you're asking. I don't think that you can separate legal skills from judicial ability.
Okay.
I mean, I've been a trial lawyer myself. I want to try a case in front of a judge who knows their way around a trial.
Mm-hmm.
I want to have to deal with a settlement with a judge who has personally had to navigate a settlement. So I can understand why that may make sense in other contexts, but legal ability is perhaps one of the most important things that we look for in judges. So
okay.
To separate and look for a comparison is quite difficult.
So it makes sense for us to compare to mid-sized and large law firms and their potential salaries versus an adjudicator that might be in private practice, for lack of a better term.
No, because I'm not saying that only individuals from private law firms are the individuals we would consider from the bench. What I'm
okay.
saying is what we look for is demonstrated excellence.
Mm-hmm.
So if you chose the path of a solo practice, mm-hmm. have you demonstrated skills that qualify you as an expert in a particular legal area?
Okay.
And there are certain indicators of that, one of which might be the success of your practice. If you have gone the private practice route and have worked your career in a private law firm, have you reached the ranks of law firm partner? Are you someone who is well regarded within your firm as an expert as well?
Okay. And then I know I have other questions, but in the interest of time, I will limit it to just one more. There have been observers and members of the public who have an ALJ or administrative law background. In that process, I've been introduced to that there is a statute that tethers their potential pay as an ALJ to either district judges or chief judges. Can you, in your understanding, are you able to give any information about how many ALJs might be affected if we were to look at raising or keeping the same or raising chief judges or district judges' salaries? How many administrative law judges would that affect because there has been some concern with the council of we don't want to limit other supporting judges, for lack of a better term, the administrative teams that look at unemployment, workers' comp, et cetera. And they do have their salaries tethered to district court and other judges. Do you know how many that would affect and what that process would?
I do not.
That trickle-down would be. Could you get that information for us?
It's really outside of the work of the commission. We don't appoint, manage, supervise, or deal with ALJs in any way.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Fox?
Mr. Chair, just
this is what they call a hot bench.
Simple question. Is the pension system for judges different than other state employees?
That is the question I cannot answer.
Okay.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
Are more applicants coming?
Oh,
sorry. Are more applicants coming from the public or private sector?
Unquestionably from the public sector.
Any other questions? If not, why a very special thank you for an excellent testimony and again preparing this on kind of short notice. But you're right, this is kind of a hot bench, and we can blame the district judges. They came over here and presented all this and got everybody really interested in this. So it's been a very helpful discussion, and I think we all we're really volunteers here too, trying to do this because we do appreciate the how democracy works and the importance of all three branches of government and competent, good people in government. So we thank you for that.
Well, it's unquestionably our pleasure. I mean, as Mr. Bethany Gomez said, you know, we view the judiciary as a resource for our state that must be preserved and for which we must handle carefully. So we're happy to be here and assist in any way we can.
Well, thank you very much. It was very helpful. Members of the council, we have one person who is asked to testify for us, a citizen here. I think we'll take, if we can make that very brief testimony, and then we'll take a break and come back for discussion. Mr. Heller, tell us, please, your name and maybe where you live, and make your comments, please.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Mr. Berg, and members of the Compensation Council. Allow me to testify today, Monday, March 18th, at your council. My name is Rick Heller, unofficially represent the twice exceptional Minnesota Statute 120B15, or House File 1370, line 1.18. Print disability found in the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 with the blind, or also found in the IDEA Act, Special Ed Law 2004. Specific things about, I had spoke once before over in the Department of Transportation bill, and I didn't see those minutes online, however, as far as the you're looking for retention and ability to pay, I just for the record so people know that the Secretary of State is exempt from Minnesota Statute 16E point subdivision 9. Currently the legislature is working on a working group called 1962 and 1727. It's likely that will very well happen. It was Greg here with the LCC, Legislative Coordinating Commission. As you know, he works with 20 groups in he wears a lot of hats here, and he has a heavy caseload. Help him out if you can. Regarding your documents currently posted online are not fully accessible. Specifically, if you would like to go to the Office Secretary of State, that's in a PowerPoint, and that's not a PDF. And that is not accessible, and they don't have to apply the accessibility law, but you might consider in the future regarding funding for them and their management that they only do IT themselves. They don't get Minute involved any more than the judicial administration law judge, Ms. Puss is over there. They're out of reach of Minute. They're not consolidated with Minute at all anymore. The legislature is. Currently, I spoke at the Joint Commission for HAVA. You might look at the handouts. The voting machine's not fully accessible. For instance, when you write in the ballot, And judges, it only spells it. It doesn't read it out loud. That's on a national level. These complaints are still open with the state. So think about the English as a second language, and then people are trying to acquire the printed word by hearing it, not by spelling it. So that could be problematic. I don't know. I've experienced those about six different times to read out loud. That's still currently a concern or a dysfunction with those machines. Basically, I live in Ramsey County, so the county pushed it on to the state, and the state pushed it on to the feds. Once again, those documents are posted now on the Minnesota legislature. That's relevant to your work to because when I look at the ballots, and unless you want to come, but, you know, it makes me wonder, well, I guess I got a one-way vote. It doesn't feel like a democracy, you know, and the relevant piece of that. So I have a handout I gave Greg. You can take this if you like. I appreciate that you would say in the minutes who I unofficially represent as well on page 9 of the handout I gave Greg about 2 weeks ago, which is a document dated 4/17/2018 from Minute Services, which specifically says I have highlighted follow prescribed protocols, manual tests critical, and accuracy assessing accessibility by simulating the user experience. Once again, if people create portable document formats, they all read out loud if you make them appropriate. If you actually manually check them, likely you may not need a working group, internal working group that does not meet the transparency levels as this council and commissions and Minnesota legislature. So once again, I appreciate that they manually check these documents. I've already expressed to the state auditor as well and Secretary of State that they consider making it more fully accessible, send them to your committee. And last but least, under the agency header salaries, which I believe the LCC created, if they manually check that, that is not fully accessible as well. And once you start checking your own documents with the required software, which is Adobe Reader, we'll all get on the same page sooner for more civic engagement for the people of Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
We appreciate your comments here, Mr. Heller. And anything further?
One thing I always say about appreciation and thanks is what we can apply and the feedback that you get from the people. And thank you for this opportunity to speak.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Any questions by council members? If not, we'll take a 10-minute recess. Thank you, Mr. Heller, and 10-minute recess.